Thank you. Neil, you were now working on the regulation related to the XXX, AXXX framework. A number of issues are being raised. Does the industry's response to these discussions suggest that they're taking a different approach to how they are funding these AG 48 and prior business reserves?
I think consistent with the fact that before, let's say 2 years ago, there was a great deal of variation as to whether reserve finance transactions were even allowed and then under what circumstances. Again, some states not allowing them at all, other states allowing them in the, you know, if I can only explain it to my mother and use, you know, the what ultimately ended up being primary security already for the economic reserve, and other states allowing perhaps some more aggressive views. I think the answer as to what's whether there's a different approach is very different company by company and state by state. If the company was already using primary security, then as Dave said, probably the only difference in the approach is the amount of primary security they're holding changed. In other states that may have allowed more aggressive use of finance captives, not only has the line, the amount of primary security has changed, but the content of what constitutes primary security has changed. And I also do want to pick up very much on what Bill and Alan have said, that the rules are just became effective the beginning of this year. So companies and regulators are still trying to figure out exactly what does this mean. You know, what did the exemptions, what are the confines of the exemptions? Because right now the AG 48 starts by covering every reinsurance transaction with XXX or AXXX business, but then it provides certain exemptions. And the exemptions right now under AG 48 are fairly airtight, but there's a question, again, do we need to change those, modify those in some ways as we move from AG 48 into the reg? And if so, how do we do that in a way that gives exactly the exemption that we want and we think should be there, but that can't be gamed to try to, you know, for people to get out from the regulation and the requirements when we don't think they should? Or as either Alan or Bill mentioned, you know, certain kinds of very complex assets, are they, you know, do they meet the definition of primary security? Are they letters of credit or maybe synthetic letters of credit or something that looks, smells, and tastes like a letter of credit, which wouldn't be allowed, but how do you define where that line is? I mean, so I think those are the kinds of questions that are being explored right now within by companies, but also by regulators as we move toward the regulation to try to say, how can we define something to allow what we want to allow without opening loopholes that people can exploit? Because once the regulation is adopted in states, it's much more difficult to come back and change that than it is to modify AG 48, an actual guideline.
Very good. I want to just kind of switch to a little bit more broader question, kind of a question for anybody or all of you at the table. What do you think the future use of captives for AXXX and XXX will be? And then also, will AG 48 and PBR reduce the use of captives? Very broad question, so have at it.
I'll go first this time. In my view, AG 48 establishes uniform standards for XXX, AXXX captives, but it's relatively neutral with regard to future captive use. It's still too early to tell because a lot of companies have waited until the dust settles and it's very clear about how these how the transactions can get structured. And they're also spending a lot of time on these calculating the AMR reserves. But my expectation is that AG 48 by itself will not substantially increase or decrease the amount of XXX, AXXX captives. But PBR clearly will substantially reduce the amount of XXX and AXXX captives once it's adopted.
I think the clear goal is that PBR adoption will help reduce the demand for these captives, but we do already hear from companies, and I'm sure you've heard it, that some think that if you take Neil's example of you got $1 billion reserve and the economic line is $700 million and $300 million is surplus, well, post-PBR, 700 will be the reserve number, but they still feel it's too conservative. And so there will be at least attempts to do something to help finance those reserves. The folks we've talked to now say, well, we're going to use what you've defined now as primary assets. And you know, at that point, I'm almost wondering, well, what do you need a captive for if it's going to be primary assets? But I think there's still going to be some advantage to segregating books of business for that. But that's what we're hearing, is that we all want to see PBR as a cure, or not even a cure, but the proper method of accounting for reserves. It's very similar to what we do in PNC. We don't prescribe reserves in property casualty. You figure it out with your own history, and PBR is meant to do something similar, and so there shouldn't be a need for alternatives. But we're still hearing that there's enough conservatism built into PBR that they'll want to do something.
We hear the exact same thing from companies. When you say, well, PBR eliminates your need for captives, you don't get a definitive yes or no on open-ended questions like that, but the sense that I get is, just echoing everything that was just said, there is still some level of conservatism in any of these reserving practices, and there may be some advantages to using a captive, but AM Best believes that indications are they won't be used as prolifically as they have in the past.
I'd like to, somehow it's easier for me to work with hypotheticals just to get the concept on my mind. So let's say you've got under today's kind of formulaic reserving approach is $1 billion statutory reserve. Let's say the PBR reserve would be 700 million, and let's say the company in its heart of hearts thinks the economic reserve is 400 million. So right now, before AG 48, before anything else, you had a $600 million incentive to do a captive finance transaction, because the statutory reserve was $1 billion and the economic reserve was $400 million. So you had a $600 million incentive to do a captive finance deal. If you went just straight to PBR, if AG 48 were out of the picture, if you just went straight to PBR, the new statutory reserve under PBR would be $700 million, but the company still thinks $400 million is the right number. So there's still an incentive to do a captive deal. It's a $300 million incentive rather than a $600 million incentive. So it's a lesser incentive, smaller incentive post-PBR than it will be pre-PBR, but it's still an incentive to do a captive finance deal. But if you combine PBR with AG 48, those two, in theory, should eliminate the incentive, because the PBR reserve would be $700 million, and AG 48 would say you've got to hold primary security at the seeding company level through trust or funds withheld equal to 700 million. So if the company's got to hold 700 million, and that's the equivalent to the statutory reserve, there is not a gap to be financed. I think where the question comes in, again, is whether, as we move from AG 48 into the regulation, whether the exemptions get changed in a way to create a loophole for a company to say, well, I really don't have to hold the 700 million under the kind of the AG 48, because now under the reg I'm exempt, or through definitions and redefinitions of primary security, if someone ends up saying, well, yes, I have to hold 700 million of primary security, but some of those elements of primary security can be kind of the equivalent of letters of credit or other kinds of things, there still, at that stage, may be a way to do either in a captive deal or still just done at the seeding company level, but somehow done in a way that they would still finance it. But in theory, PBR plus AG 48 ought to eliminate the incentive for captive finance transactions, not, as Dr. Hoyt said, when there's always a question as to whether IRS or other kinds of things, but for financing part, it ought to eliminate that percentage. We'll have to see whether that plays out that way.
And now you understand the mom rule, because what I have seen of sketches on a napkin of a post-PBR world and use of captives post-PBR would not satisfy the mom rule.
Thank you, David, and the rest of the panel. For Bill and Alan, the NEIC is pursuing changes to the statutory requirements on variable annuities. Do you believe those will, again, eliminate the use of variable annuity captives?
I think the variable annuity issues working groups initiatives are expected to reduce future use of VA captives, but it's too soon to tell yet whether they will be completely eliminated or whether they will just be limited to certain circumstances, companies with certain kinds of products or based on certain organizational structures for whom the use of a captive would reduce risk or otherwise be attractive for them for some reason.
The VA captive, on the VA accounting, faced, getting tongue-tied. But anyway, the reserving practices for VAs is very, very convoluted and complex. We've talked to actuarial firms, and there's schematics that would keep you up at night. The whole point of trying to change the paradigm so that there's less reliance on captives, I think, is a way to better align the economics with the changes in market value of the derivatives that are used. Most of this applies to guarantees, the living benefit guarantees that are embedded in the VA contract, not so much the base contract. And that tail risk creates a lot of volatility in the statements, given the changes in the interest rates or changes in the markets, and the derivatives and the underlying reserves don't move necessarily in an intuitive manner, creating a lot of noise in the statutory statement, which is why companies have started to move things onto the captive. And there are other advantages too. There's some tax advantages to it as well. We are in discussions with some companies. They are trying to work around rules that maybe eventually become law. So I think longer term you will see the elimination or the reduction of VA captives, but I think it's early in the game, you know, to say definitively on how that's going to play out. I do think that things need to change so at least economics makes sense for a company, that their hedging program is reflected, is a reduction of risk and not just a lot of statutory noise. C3 phase two and AG 43 is what I was groping with when I said the reserving practices.
Thank you, Bill. To David, with respect to captives in general, what trends are you seeing and how captives are structured and can you give us a sense on what's driving those changes?
Sure, it's a two-part question, so I'll give you a two-part answer. And this is back to real captives, the way I like them. As far as structures of captives goes, there's really a lot more of the same. We're still seeing pure captives formed quickly, a fair number of risk retention groups. Probably the only structural change, I would say, is that we're seeing a lot more cells now. Most states have some sort of a cell company legislation, as Dr. Hoyt showed. And we're seeing a lot more stop loss for healthcare programs being put into groups where you have some self-funded employers get together and share a layer of risk in the stop loss range and then cede the rest off to the traditional market. And that helps them drive down their cost, they hope. And that's what the drivers are. The drivers are what they've always been. You've got either a problem to solve, which is the cost and availability of traditional insurance, especially in healthcare. That's a huge issue now. And that's driving a lot of companies to get into group programs for self-funded employee benefits and using stop-loss programs. And then there's the opportunity that some captives can recognize. So you'll see opportunity drives the formation of the 831B captives. It's an opportunity to put a captive together and set aside some funds tax advantaged to pay future losses. Opportunity is what's driving the formation of captives to access the Federal Home Loan Bank system. And opportunities drive the big box stores having captives to insure the electronic products you buy. So it's still the same drivers.
Very good. To Bill and Alan, what trends are you folks seeing in the impact of captive reinsurance on the life insurer ratings?
That's a difficult question to answer directly because, for one, the captive information is not generally publicly available. Just to repeat my earlier comments, we do a full analysis of the captives and the impact on the primary company. We also take into consideration that not all captive solutions are created equally. There are some that pass the risk on more to a third party than others, where more of the risk is retained. It's also the reliance and the amount of reserves that are financed, and then it does release RBC in the primary company. And what does that company do? Do they do share buybacks, or do they employ in other venues at higher margin business? So sometimes the capital just isn't there anymore. So there's a lot of facts that go into evaluating a company's rating. But in the public domain and our rating rationales and press releases, we haven't to date tied any rating action directly to the use of captives. So I can't answer it directly if they did or didn't. But I just want to leave you with the thought that there's a lot of analysis that goes on with the captive, and it ultimately is baked into the final rating evaluation.
Taking a broader perspective, looking across the three other rating agencies that assign financial strength ratings to life companies, consistent with AM Best, I am not familiar with any life captive transactions that have resulted in ratings actions by a rating agency. Every life company is very careful to manage their rating agency relationship, and they don't want to rock the boat with the rating agency, so usually what they're doing is, in advance of a transaction, they're communicating with the rating agency when they reach certain milestones to keep their analyst informed. The analyst does not want to get surprised and read in the paper or online today that something happened that with the company that they rate and they were not aware of it. Now, that said, we've seen, I think it's each of the four rating agencies that assign financial strength ratings to life companies in the U.S. have issued some captive-related criteria over the last few years. And so sometimes they're not events, they're just refreshing the criteria from a few years ago and with no material changes, but sometimes there are material changes. And when those material changes happen, usually there's some advance warning about it that they're putting out an exposure draft for comment, just like the NAIC does. And when there's a material change, companies need to go back to the drawing board and say, okay, how is this going to affect me? They might have multiple discussions with their analyst and the captive-related experts within that rating agency to make sure that their current captive transaction structure would not result in an adverse ratings action. And if it would, then some of them, and we've actually seen this happen, will make changes. So they'll go back to the financing providers and negotiate amendments to the agreements in order to avoid an adverse ratings action.
So one more, and just so you folks in the audience are ready, should you have questions, should you want to react to some of the statements said earlier, or just have a general question, after this next set of back and forth, I'd really encourage you to come up to the microphone and address a question to the group or one of the presenters individually. So kind of giving a quick warning on that. But before that, with respect to captives in general, David and Alan, would you mind commenting on, as we saw with part of Dr. Hoyt's presentation, the increase in captive domiciles and how are states dealing with the rapid market growth in captives?
I brought a visual aid to explain why states pass captive laws. it's dollars. Vermont years ago did a study on the economic impact of captive insurance in Vermont. Vermont's a very small state. If you take us all and put us into one town, it's equivalent to the Boise, Idaho metropolitan area. So there's not a lot of people in Vermont, so it didn't take much to make an impact and affect our legislature and get their attention. So even when we had 100 jobs and $2 million in tax revenue, that was a big deal. Now we've got 1,400 jobs and $25 million in revenues, and that's a really big deal in Vermont. That's 2% of our general fund. So we did an economic impact study. Other states called up our economic development department and said, under the public records law, we'd like to see that, may we please? Thank you very much. And so we don't do studies anymore because we just give them away. But so that's what's driving states forming, having captive legislation, whether it's just the legislature with the insurance department or the legislature working on its own, dollar signs will drive things to happen. We think there's room. We're willing to share. We've got our share of the captive business, and we still get plenty of new business, and there's plenty of business to go around. And, a lot of it is not particularly tough. If you're talking a small captive owned by a single parent company, it doesn't take a lot of resources to regulate that. They're watching their own money closer than you ever could. It's just a matter of, being the gatekeeper and watching who's coming in, then keeping an eye on them after the fact. And it's not rocket science until you start getting into risk retention groups and XXX captives. It's not that much work, so it's kind of easy money almost.
We've also seen a handful of states create captive laws designed not to broadly market captives domiciled in their state to all companies in the industry, but focus solely on life companies domiciled in their state. And I think the regulatory motivation there, and there might be some regulators in the audience who might have different perspectives, I'd love to hear them, but my hypothesis is that because of the growing group solvency regulatory initiative at the NAIC, by having their domestic companies cede to a domestic captive, that regulator, that state insurance department maintains their same degree of influence with regard to group solvency, whereas otherwise if it were to cede to another state, they would have to share that influence with another state. And so that's the sense that I have, but I'd be very happy to hear if there are other perspectives.
I'll give just a slight comment, actually wearing a different hat, and that's the accreditation program hat. I think as Dave indicated, if it's a pure captive situation, it's not all that difficult from a regulatory perspective. But I think what frequently happens as states develop new captive legislation is they somehow become a magnet, in addition to pure captives, for also things like risk retention groups, for other things that are much more complex. And actually, it's quite difficult. I mean, that's a very different and much more difficult regulatory challenge when you're dealing with companies like that. It's typically a monoline company, so it doesn't have diversification of business. It frequently is either thinly capitalized and or capitalized with less than 100% of standard admitted assets. And it doesn't always follow in quite the same way that, a more traditional insurance company would, all the checks and balances that you've got in those different systems. And so it actually requires a great deal of regulatory resources to deal with those kinds of captives. And I think sometimes states will get the study that, Dave talked about. They'll see the dollar sign, they'll form captive legislation, and then they start realizing it's actually much more difficult than we thought it would be. And one of the things that we've seen is that states will start with that process, and then as they get more involved with it, say, wait a minute, let's try to winnow out some of these risk retention groups on the more complex side, and let's try to focus more on the pure captives, or at least have a better balance between the two. So when you think of the captive industry, it actually really is multiple industries rather than one industry, and each of those industries requires a different regulatory response and level of regulatory attention.
Thank you, Neil. So I want to just take a quick break here. One housekeeping item, which I completely forgot to do at the beginning. The second password for the second program this session is a small lower cap. The title of this program is small CAPT 55A. So I beg your forgiveness for forgetting to announce that initially. So with that, does anyone have any questions? There's been a lot of comments, a lot of thoughtful things said here. I'm wondering if anybody would like to ask a question of our panel at this point. There's murmuring, but no questions. I guess you've answered all their questions, folks. So I guess I have one final question for the group, and it's kind of a a very broad one. But do you think the current framework, which was originally set up for single and group captives, is adequate? Excuse me. Even though you weren't there at the beginning.
As far as traditional captives, single parents and groups, I think it is. If you're talking about captives, as we discussed, it's not a particularly complex company. And once you get to risk retention groups, then you have to follow all the same rules that you do for a traditional company. As far as accreditation standards goes, the parallels in parts A, B, C, and D, risk retention group regulation is almost the same thing as traditional insurance company regulation, with a few carve-outs because it's a different law. And there's a couple other differences, but we still have to do examinations, and we have to do risk-focused examinations, and we have to do risk-focused surveillance, all the same things. So it's as long as you have the staff and the capability and the resources to do that, that framework still works. Once you start getting into reinsurance of insurance companies, then maybe there's some flaws or things we need to work on, because I can remember in 2008, we all did some things to help AIG, and we formed a captive from AIG to assume some of their risk. AIG formed it. And the question that came up in the office was, isn't this just reinsurance? This isn't really captive business. This isn't what we think of as a captive. This is a reinsurance company taking on the risk of AIG, of policyholder risk. And so that's where we really need to think more about what we're doing when we reinsure insurance companies for everyday man on the street kind of policyholders.
Others that have a thought on that? All right, if not, we're running just a bit early. Joe, do you have a question for the panel, or are you just getting ready for yours? Oh, you're just getting ready for yours. Very good. I just want to ask the audience to thank, and I'm very grateful to have a very dedicated and thoughtful group, a panel up here today to really share some very incredible thoughts on this very, very complicated set of circumstances in and around captives and the regulation thereof. So. Would you please welcome, or please join me in thanking our panel. Sorry.